thank you for downloading Business Matters live on the BBC World Service 5 days a week at 9 a.m. Singapore time and for 1 week only, 9 p.m. New York time.
BBC World Service, welcome to Business Matters at 1 o'clock GMT. And today, China takes a great leap upward in its space program. Should NASA be nervous?
I think NASA should be nervous, and for a couple of reasons. Number one, this is part of China's national strategy. This is part of their economic and grand power rejuvenation.
And from space to politics, we'll ask how well Xi Jinping is doing in molding China's national and provincial leadership to his will. Later, the UK government slapped down by three High Court judges over Brexit, and Sopal's Soapbox, our North America editor, lets rip at length about the election, of course.
This is the BBC News. Hello, I'm Jonathan Izard. Republicans are stepping up campaigning for the US presidential election next Tuesday as polls suggest a tighter race than anticipated. Donald Trump's former Republican rival, Senator Ted Cruz, rallied supporters in the state of Iowa. In the swing state of North Carolina, the Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton called on the crowd to imagine life under a Trump presidency. At his own rally in the state, Mr. Trump appealed specifically to Army veterans to support him.
And finally, a commitment to only engage the use of military forces when it's vital for national security interests of the United States. We will stop trying to build foreign democracies, topple regimes, and race recklessly to intervene in situations that we have no right to be there, folks. We want strength in this country. We want to protect our country.
The Paris Agreement on climate change has come into force, obliging governments to keep the global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The United Nations climate chief, Patricia Espinosa, described it as a turning point in the fight against global warming. Roger Harabin has the details.
The Paris deal is the first agreement tying rich and poor nations in a common endeavour to protect the climate. Governments have agreed to keep the global temperature rise to 2 degrees, preferably 1.5 degrees. National targets for cutting carbon emissions are voluntary. The UN tried a mandatory treaty before, but countries that were failing to meet their targets simply quit. But the process of the Paris deal is binding, including a commitment for governments to keep returning to the issue, to ratchet up their clean energy targets that they all agree are currently inadequate.
Autumn rains in Northern California have helped pull about a quarter of the state out of its worst ever drought. Parts of Northern California saw rainfall three times or more above normal. The drought, though, remains serious in Central and Southern California. Emergency measures remain in place in more than 40% of the state, the most populous in the US. A scientific study has found that smoking 20 cigarettes a day for a year creates up to 150 genetic mutations in every cell in the lungs. An international team of scientists analysed DNA from more than 5,000 cancer tumours from smokers and non-smokers. They found mutations in each cell in the larynx, mouth, bladder and liver. Professor Sir Mike Stratton, the joint lead author, said DNA analysis would help to understand the mechanisms that trigger other kinds of cancers.
By looking in the DNA of those cancers, we will find these mutational signatures, these archaeological traces of the past exposures. These will provide us clues to the agents that are responsible, and that will lead potentially to prevention.
You're listening to The World News from the BBC. The Turkish authorities have detained 11 MPs from the pro-Kurdish HDP party, including its leaders. Reports say police raided the houses of Selahattin Demirtas and Figen Yüksekdag as part of an anti-terrorist investigation. A fellow MP told the BBC the parliamentarians had been illegally hijacked. A reporter in Istanbul says access to Facebook and Twitter has been blocked. A coroner in Australia has found that the death of the cricketer Philip Hughes was a tragic accident for which no one should be blamed. The international batsman was hit by a fast ball in a match 2 years ago. He suffered a brain hemorrhage and died 2 days later. From Sydney, here's Howell Griffiths.
Philip Hughes' death shocked the world's cricket community. His family believe he was the victim of so-called sledging, where a player is subjected to threatened intimidation. But the coroner ruled that even if there was an attempt to unsettle Hughes, the actions didn't contribute towards his death. Coroner Michael Barnes did question why, in his words, such a beautiful game should need an ugly underside, suggesting that increased commercial pressures on players to win may be to blame. He also called for improved medical backup at games after it emerged that it took 6 minutes for anyone to call an ambulance after Hughes collapsed at the wicket.
Police in the American state of North Dakota have arrested 14 protesters at the state capitol building. They had refused to leave the governor's residence where they'd been demonstrating against plans to build an oil pipeline near the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. Members of the Sioux Nation say the proposed pipeline could harm water supplies and damage sacred tribal sites. Researchers in the United States say a species of fish that regenerates its spinal cord could hold the key to helping paralysed humans walk again. Scientists have found that after a zebrafish's spinal cord is cut, it uses a protein to build a bridge between the two ends. Humans have a version of the protein that's 90% the same, although it's unable to regenerate our backbones. BBC World Service News.
Hello, welcome. This is Fergus Nicol and Business Matters. In a moment, our main headline: China, the space race, and the miracle fuel that may lie on the moon. Also this half hour, a legal slapdown for the British government over its plans to cut Parliament out of the Brexit process.
By withdrawing from the EU, you are effectively revoking that act. And the court concluded that it is not government that can do that, but it is only for Parliament to be able to do that.
Let's welcome our guests this hour on Business Matters. Rosie Bloor is China correspondent for The Economist and joins us from Beijing this morning. Hello, Rosie. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also back with us from the United States, Dr. Richard Wolff, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts. He's also a visiting professor at the New School in New York itself and the founder of Democracy at Work. Professor Wolff, thank you so much for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to talk a lot about China. We're going to talk about the economy, about politics. But first, science, with the question, is China about to overtake America in space? There we go, the successful launch of the Long March CZ-5 rocket from the Wenchang Satellite Launch Center in Hainan. Chan Yulong is chief engineer at the State Administration of Science, Technology and Industry for National Defense, and he could perhaps be forgiven for a smidgen of smugness.
Just a moment ago, we witnessed together our country's most powerful rocket ever, Long March 5, being lifted simultaneously by its 10 engines. According to the latest data, the load combination is running smoothly in orbit. The maiden flight of Long March 5 has been a complete success.
To assess the state of the 21st century space race, we turn to academic and author Vikram Mancharamani. Should NASA be nervous?
The space program has four primary objectives from my perspective. Number one, it is about science and technological development, and that the science effort will hopefully have spin-off impacts through their commercial technologies that are developed, etc. So that's a rejuvenizing the innovation engine of the Chinese science and applied science apparatus. So that's number one. Number two, there is this effort to revitalize Chinese nationalism, which I think is particularly timely right now, given the economic slowdown. So it's always nice to have a positive, supportive population when the economic opportunity set may be dwindling. Number three, I think there are military applications. And so we know that the Chinese have been developing military capabilities in space, anti-satellite technologies and weapons to take out competitor satellites. So that's number three. Number four, and perhaps one of the more interesting developments that could emerge from the Chinese space program, is the development in the energy sphere. So they are toying with the idea of mining the moon for helium-3. Now, helium-3 is an isotope that is rarely available on Earth, but is plentiful on the moon because the moon doesn't have an atmosphere and so collects these isotopes. That source could be so efficient as to power energy needs for an entire country with several payloads of helium-3 taken from the surface of the moon. And so this is something I think they have in the back of their mind as a potential ambition for their lunar exploration.
That's absolutely fantastic. I've never even heard of helium-3, and you're talking about many, many years of potential power.
It's also contingent upon the development of efficient fusion technologies. But theoretically, the helium-3, used appropriately in fusion technology, could power countries for years and years to come.
You talked about nationalism, and of course, the United States, the Soviet Union, space was a big part of the Cold War and the rival nationalisms there. Is America now left flat-footed by the grounding of the shuttle, by NASA's problems, by, frankly, a massive shortfall in budgeting from Washington?
Look, I think if we were to think about a space race emerging, which I think there is, look, the Indians have been active in space, the Chinese are active in space, the Russians are active in space, the United States is actually falling behind, relatively speaking. And I emphasize the relatively speaking because the U.S. has such a large lead in space that there isn't an imminent risk to the U.S. of falling behind, but on a incremental basis, the Chinese are definitely closing the gap, if not converging rapidly. So there's a couple of things I would point to. Number one, NASA hasn't launched an astronaut into space since 2011 without the help of the Russians. That means the U.S. space program has been dependent upon the Russians for launching men into space, astronauts, and has been dependent upon the private industry, SpaceX, etc., in developing the capability to send payloads into space.
One last thought, Vikram. The Chinese are due to build their own space station, somewhere to stay in space. And the International Space Station, of course, has been there for some while. Will anybody else get to join the Chinese in their project?
Well, it's an interesting question that you ask, because one tidbit that's worth recalling here is that the U.S. Congress has actually prohibited U.S. scientists at NASA and the White House Office of Science and Technology from collaborating with the Chinese on certain space matters. And so you can imagine that the U.S. astronauts and U.S. space research efforts may not be as welcome on the Chinese space station, given these restrictions that have existed. But I do know that the Chinese have been collaborating with the Russians on possible space endeavors, and I can imagine that the Chinese try to embrace a different set of potential partners in space than the United States and the U.S. Western ecosystem.
Thanks to Vikram Mancharamani. And from space now to politics. The Chinese Communist Party this week published two sets of new disciplinary rules for all party members. It's partly about behaviour, but it's also about relationships and supervision within the party. President Xi Jinping said political life in China has been generally good, but prominent problems remain, he said, and urgently need to be addressed. We'll talk about the economy as well over the next few minutes, but let's go to Rosie first in Beijing. And Rosie, I don't know whether you had any comments about the space issue, first of all, before we get into the nitty-gritty of party apparatus.
Well, the one other thing to say is that China has also hailed this Long March 5 in the year of the 80th anniversary of the end of the Long March as also an era of environmentally friendly rockets. So it's also saying that it did this great thing with green fuel. So it's adding another string to its bow there.
And green fuel is something we can talk about that as we get into a discussion of the economy, because they have been going gangbusters in a lot of different green fuel, as well as we heard in recent weeks about still doing coal fire, etc. But let's get into the politics first of all. And this party meeting has just been fascinating. I've been trying to catch up with some of the politics of it through the China Daily site, which gives us a sort of government insight, I guess. And here you've got Xi Jinping naming and shaming senior party officials for, quote, political cravings and lust for power, corruption too. What's going on?
Right, well, this has actually been going on since Xi Jinping came to power in 2012. So he's launched this huge anti-corruption campaign. It's been very popular in China because everyone knows that corruption is a huge problem. And he has both named and shamed very, very top people, a former member of the Politburo, Zhou Yuankang, who used to have command of the security apparatus, top generals from the PLA, from the army, and as well hundreds of thousands of officers throughout the Communist Party and beyond. So in that sense, it's more of the same. But what Xi Jinping is trying to do now is trying to inculcate everyone with his idea that this is a life and death struggle, that if the Communist Party can't rule cleanly and well, then China is doomed. So he's saying, you know, the USSR fell essentially because people didn't stand up for it. It had a huge corruption problem. No one tried to save it. It just sort of died in its own slurry of corruption. China's not going to do that. So he's trying to say this is the important thing for China now.
So a lack of discipline poses an existential threat to the party.
That's exactly right. That is how he sees it. And that is why we get these kind of extraordinary and often extremely boring and weird documents, which sort of spell out, you know, you can only be promoted if you do well in your job, not by paying for it. Things that we would have thought were obvious. But you get reams and reams of documents basically saying, you know, you promote people for doing stuff well. You can't buy promotions. You behave cleanly. You don't let your family members use your office. All these things that we would have thought were obvious, that this is an existential problem for China.
Richard Wolff, I'd like to bring you in and ask you whether you see this kind of party management required at the economic level in China too.
Absolutely. And I think that's how to understand it. The Chinese society is now facing a fundamental turning point. They made a decision. They took a chance 20, 25 years ago to commit to an export-led industrialization program, to try to become a major world power economically, which they've done, by focusing on producing for everybody else in the world, becoming the manufacturer for everyone else. What they therefore took as a risk has now come to pass. Namely, the rest of the world is in economic difficulty. Europe, North America, Japan can't buy anything like what it used to buy from the Chinese. And so now they're stuck. They have to make a fundamental switch, reorient their economy to be a domestic production consumption entity rather than an export-led development society. And in order to get that kind of a transition done in a reasonable amount of years, which is very, very difficult under the best of circumstances, they need a political apparatus from the top to the bottom, down to the little village level, that is on board, is believed and trusted by the people, and able to function as the organizer for this massive transformation in a society that has already gone through a disruptive transformation as it became an industrial power. And I think the leaders in China understand that if they haven't got a secure, well-liked, well-functioning political apparatus, the chances of pulling off this transition from export to domestic-led economic development is in deep trouble.
Excellent. Hold that thought. Rosie, I'm going to come to you in just a moment, but we're going to get our news headlines a little after 4:15. Here's Jonathan.
Leading Republicans are campaigning for Donald Trump as the race for the White House becomes tighter. Mr. Trump's wife, Melania, and his daughter, Ivanka, have also been speaking on his behalf. In North Carolina, the Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, called on the crowd to imagine life under a Trump presidency. A global treaty to tackle climate change has come into force. The Paris Agreement has been hailed as a turning point in the fight against global warming. The authorities in California say plentiful autumn rains have lifted a quarter of the state out of its worst ever drought. Parts of northern California saw rainfall three times above normal, but the drought remains serious in central and southern California. And police in Turkey have detained much of the leadership of the main pro-Kurdish political party.
More headlines for you from Jonathan at 4:30. Back to Rosie then. Lots of points to pick up from Richard's remarks. And the one phrase that I seized upon in my own mind was from top to bottom. How hard is it for Xi Jinping to make provincial officials do what he wants politically and economically?
unbelievably hard, actually, partly because one of the ways in which China has managed its economic miracle is to allow local government officials a certain amount of freedom to experiment, try new things, see what works, spread it. And so you've had an amount of delegation that's been quite impressive, and you've had different government officials doing different things. But the second thing is that as Richard says, they're trying to now turn something around, and the incentives are different. And these create problems for local government officials, because when you close the factory, you close your steel mill, you close your coal mine, this might be good for national targets, but in terms of your local population, what you risk is making thousands of people, at times hundreds of thousands of people, unemployed or very much less employed. You risk unrest, and that is something that a lot of local government officials don't want to do. Not to mention, of course, the local banks that have loaned to these mills that then shut, etc., etc., the local property market that relies on these local workers to buy the houses. So it's a huge problem for a central government to basically say, local officials, do what I say, don't worry about your bit.
Mm. Richard, zoom in on the steel sector. Rosie just mentioned that. What is going on in a crucial sector like that? We've seen ripples in steel through the world, and we've talked a lot about it from a UK perspective. We've talked about India. What is going on in China, and how hard is it to change, you know, to operate at a provincial level, as Rosie was describing, in steel?
Well, I think in steel, as in a number of other industries, the shift from the export orientation, and we should always remember that they continue to be a major exporter and rely on that to a degree that makes many of us who observe very nervous. But having said that, trying to shift more and more into the domestic sources of demand for their steel capacity, which is enormous, they've taken to solving that problem by issuing debt. In other words, by enabling a domestic economy that simply didn't have the income with which to pay for the refocusing of Chinese industry to the home market, to solve that problem by allowing an explosion of credit at every level beyond anything anyone had ever seen. And part of that local and mid-level corruption is that, to use a colorful metaphor, the economy is awash in credit upon credit, loosely given, poorly supervised, in the desperate hope that at least some of it will translate into orders that can keep steel, auto, and many, many other industries established and newly emerging able to function in a domestic market, which can only buy if it has that kind of credit. Well, when you don't have a well-developed credit system in the first place, and you have the problem of corruption, flooding an economy with credit, as we know from the West, is going to lead to the very kinds of endless scandals and misallocations that the Chinese are discovering and is upsetting them.
Rosie, did you want to add anything else on steel? Because I wanted to just move on quickly and talk about the belt and the road and the wider projection of Chinese economic power. Anything on steel, Kui?
Well, the one thing to add on steel is this is an interesting one, because this is one where Xi Jinping specifically came out and said, this is what I want to happen. It's not just a general government policy. He put his name to it. This was absolutely top-down policy, which has not been followed.
OK, so let's talk about broader projection we talked a little bit about the sort of Neo Silk Road project reaching right into Central Asia. How critical is that for Mr. Xi, Rosie, or is that something that will only see fruit way after he's left office?
I suspect that the real fruit will be after he's left office, if indeed we get the real fruit, but we're going to hear a lot more about it, partly because this is a way that China thinks it's both economic and political power. It ties people into China's economy. It ties people into China's political patronage. And it's a way of exporting, you know, emissions, and it's a way of exporting some of China's prowess in high-speed rail, etc. So it's, you know, many people have called it China's Marshall Plan, and I think that's a very good way of thinking about it.
Richard?
Yeah, again, it's the use of credit, which is what the Marshall Plan was as well. Credit to others in order to boost your own economic demand and your own industrial growth. I might throw a statistic that puts it into perspective. I learned today that the top 20 shipping companies in the world, the ones who have the boats with the containers on them, for the first time in history, all 20 of the top shipping companies will show no profit at all for the year 2016. This is a disaster of global proportions, undercutting any hope of economic recovery that anyone who's serious can continue to talk about. It's world trade crumbling in many ways, and I think the Chinese are extremely vulnerable, even now after the adjustments they've made, and they are looking very much at extreme measures like new trade initiatives, like a Marshall Plan for their neighbors and so on, because they understand they have got to find new ways to support the demand for the industrial capacity they've created, or else risk a dangerous social situation.
Richard, thanks. Rosie, too. Much more from them in the second half of the programme. Here in the UK, Brexit means Brexit. That's been Theresa May's mantra since she took over the leadership of the party, Conservative Party, and therefore the government, following the resignation of David Cameron. Well, now spanners are in works and cats are among pigeons because she and her government have been dealt a setback by the High Court, which has ruled the government must get parliamentary approval before formally triggering the exit clause. The Prime Minister had insisted that she could invoke what's known as the royal prerogative to bypass Parliament. But a number of legal experts had warned long before the June referendum that invoking Article 50 could not be done without the authorisation of an Act of Parliament. Here's Philip Souter of the law firm Clifford Chance.
The European Communities Act 1972 is the key piece of legislation in the UK which gives effect to EU law in the UK. And it is by virtue of that act, which was passed into law by Parliament, that we are members of the EU. And that act gives individuals in the UK certain rights. So by withdrawing from the EU, you are effectively revoking that act. And the court concluded that it is not government that can do that, but it is only for Parliament to be able to do that.
So just to be clear on this, Parliament conferred those rights by passing that 1972 bit of legislation. The government cannot take those rights away under law by any kind of prerogative.
That is what the court concluded.
Can you just explain, before we move on, the question of prerogative? Am I right in thinking that it's usually left to perhaps foreign affairs items that Parliament doesn't feel the need to legislate on routinely?
The royal prerogative is something of a historical anomaly. It was first adjudicated upon in the courts in really the 17th century, and the courts concluded that the Crown could do nothing without the approval of Parliament, or that Parliament was supreme. And what this means practically is that the Crown's powers, or the government's powers, to do things that are sort of outside of the scope of statute only apply to things that haven't been legislated upon. And until relatively recently, that, for example, included the making and withdrawing from treaties. It also included the embarking upon military action and various other things like that. And those issues have more recently seen legislation which gives Parliament more of a say. And there have also been votes on military action in the last couple of years, which have arguably created a new parliamentary convention which overrides the royal prerogative in that area.
So we now know legislation can only be altered by legislation, but the government wants to appeal. Do they have any grounds in your views?
It looks as if the appeal is going to be run on the same grounds, and it's anyone's guess, frankly, what the outcome of that is going to be. But what's interesting about this judgment is that it's a unanimous judgment of all three judges. There was no dissenting judgment. And it doesn't appear as if they had any great difficulty in arriving at this judgment. It's a very clear and quite certain judgment.
Thanks to Philip Souter of Clifford Chance. We're coming up to our news summary here on Business Matters. And no, we haven't forgotten the election. We'll talk about that next. Thank you. Hello, welcome back. It's time for the latest in our weekly series of extended reports from our North America editor on the mercifully soon to be concluded presidential campaign. You might call it Election Circus Watch. We call it Sopel's Soapbox.
Say it quietly. It's all going to be over soon. There are just a few days left of what has seemed like a lifetime-long campaign for the presidency. Now, if you were listening to our podcast last week, you might have heard me say this. It's almost as though Hillary Clinton is on cruise control. What I meant to say was, oh my God, fasten the seatbelt, something terrible is happening. What happened, of course, last Friday was a little letter sent to a congressional committee by the director of the FBI, James Comey.
I need to open with a very critical breaking news announcement.
Suddenly, it seemed like he had thrown the biggest bomb you've ever seen into the middle of this election campaign.
The FBI has just sent a letter to Congress informing them that they have discovered new emails pertaining to the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's investigation.
And with that, a Trump campaign that had looked a little bit listless, adrift, not really going anywhere, suddenly had direction, purpose, vim, and vigor.
This is bigger than Watergate. This is bigger than Watergate, in my opinion.
I have now seen Director Comey's letter to Congress.
And with that intervention, with the momentum it's given Donald Trump, the polls have undoubtedly tightened. What seemed like maybe a foregone conclusion now seems anything but.
Voting is already underway in our country. So the American people deserve to get the full and complete facts immediately.
And how do you know the physical manifestation of that? Well, look at where the TV advertising spend is taking place. It had been concentrated in the traditional key battlegrounds, Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania. But now the money is starting to be spent elsewhere by both the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign. Wisconsin, Michigan, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona. States that had seemed settled suddenly seem up for grabs. And that must give Democrats serious concern.
You know, we've heard these rumors. We don't know what to believe. And I'm sure there will be even more rumors. That's why it is incumbent upon the FBI to tell us what they're talking about.
So what should we read into the James Comey intervention? The argument for is that, frankly, if you have an investigation into another computer and more emails, not to reveal it would seem like you were covering something up if something major came out after the election. Or worse still, the risk that something might leak from within the FBI that could potentially be even more damaging. Perhaps he felt himself between a rock and a hard place. But it all comes down to something called the Hatch Act. And if you're not familiar with bits of US law, let me just roughly tell you what it says. It says that if you are in a federal agency, like the FBI, law enforcement officer, then you are legally required not to do anything that could influence the outcome of an election. And the charge is that by intervening so directly, whatever the motive, you have in effect potentially altered the outcome of some races, of some states, of potentially even the election itself. So I spoke to Richard Painter. He was the chief ethics lawyer, not an easy thing to say, in the Bush administration, Bush 43, George W. Bush. He's a lifelong Republican. I asked him what he made of the Comey letter.
And then he sends the letter, and it is almost immediately put up on the Internet for public consumption and for everybody, including Donald Trump, to interpret and, of course, misinterpret.
So you think it was a breach of the law?
Yes, I think it was a breach of the Hatch Act for the FBI to send that letter to Congress. It's a violation of Justice Department policy to comment on investigations, and the FBI should not make exceptions to that by promising members of Congress that they will get Election Eve updates on investigations concerning their political opponents.
How unusual is it for the FBI to comment publicly on an investigation that is ongoing?
They almost never do that. They also almost never comment when they open an investigation or reopen an investigation that has been closed. It's not at all certain whether this particular investigation has been reopened or not. They did not say that they were. But they do not comment publicly on that in almost all cases. They will, of course, if there's an act of terrorism or something, they would publicly say we are investigating it. But they don't do much more than that, and they only do that in extraordinary circumstances.
What did you make of what happened last Friday with that letter that James Comey sent to Congress?
Well, the members of the Congressional Committee, which is controlled by the Republicans, wanted an update on the investigation of Hillary Clinton's email. What they really wanted was criminal charges to be brought against Hillary Clinton, but the facts did not justify the filing of any criminal charges against anybody. So the FBI did not do that. But then the committee said, we want an update of all developments, and we want you to notify us. And that was the fatal mistake of Mr. Comey, was to agree to that. Members of Congress do not have the right to updates from the FBI on investigations involving their political opponents. And they certainly don't have a right to that 10 days before an election.
What do you think is going on here? What are the pressures that are within the FBI? A lot of reports suggesting maybe the FBI is at war with itself, and that if James Comey hadn't done that, then there would have been leaks and the effect might have been even worse.
Well, there was really nothing to leak. All they had found was a computer belonging to a close associate of Hillary Clinton that would obviously have a lot of emails on it from Hillary Clinton. They had already gone through all the emails going out of Hillary Clinton's server. Some of those were lost. So there is a possibility there's something on this other computer on the receiving end that was not in the original a batch of emails that they looked at. But they had nothing new.
So what do you think? I mean, James Comey is a very experienced operative as a prosecutor, investigator, but he's operated in a political dimension for decades. He must have been aware of what the consequence of his actions would be.
Well, exactly. And that's why I do think that he violated the Hatch Act, even if he himself did not want to sway the election. There's some evidence of animosity that he might have toward Hillary Clinton. He made comments he shouldn't have last July about her actions when he decided that no criminal charges were warranted against anybody. He made comments he shouldn't have that were, I think, unfair to her. But that is beside the point, that even if he had no animosity toward her, or even if he didn't want her to lose, he clearly knew exactly what the members of that committee were going to do with that letter. And that's just wrong. That's not the way we do business in our country. The FBI is not to be used for political purposes. And he should have realized that he was being used for just that.
You worked in the Bush White House. You were the ethics lawyer there. So, and I know you weren't not a Trump supporter, but you have been a longstanding Republican. I just wonder whether you have spoken to many of your colleagues who have similar feelings that you do about the way this has been handled, but feel they, for whatever reason, can't break cover.
Well, yes, there's very strong a feeling across the political spectrum that the FBI never should have gotten itself dragged into an election. I am free to say what I want to about Secretary Clinton and Mr. Trump, but the director of the FBI should not be doing that in his official capacity only 10 days before an election.
But presumably now the damage is done. You can't undo it. You can't say, oh, I didn't mean to say that. And even if he came back and said, oh, we found nothing untoward, the damage would have been inflicted.
Well, I think that he should acknowledge that it was wrong to send the letter. It was wrong for the members of Congress to pressure him in this way. He caved into the pressure. And second, that the letter actually didn't say anything, that the letter is being completely misinterpreted. I think at this point he could explain that at the time the letter was written, all they had was a computer that they did not have a search warrant to examine, that undoubtedly had some emails coming from Secretary Clinton and back and forth, that probably most of those, if not all of them, are emails they've already seen. And that does not mean they're reopening the investigation. That language was never used in that letter. And yet it's been misinterpreted that way. So I think he could clarify what the letter means, and he could say that it should never have been sent. And we're just going to go forward and make sure we protect the independence of the FBI in the future.
My final question, is it going to have an effect?
Well, I think in the election, by the time the dust settles next Tuesday, I think it's going to probably not have much of an effect on the election. Unfortunately, I think it makes my own party, the Republican Party, look pretty awful because the members of the committee were pressuring the FBI to engage in conduct the FBI never should engage in. They were trying to use the FBI for political purposes. It's not just about Donald Trump. I think a lot of them couldn't care less about Donald Trump, but every one of them is running for re-election on a ticket that has Donald Trump at the top. And a lot of them are very scared of losing their seats. But that does not justify this type of abuse of power. So the long-term political blowback the most serious situation is that both parties could use the FBI this way. And the last thing I want to do is have Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump going to the White House thinking that members of Congress or the president can use the FBI for opposition research on their opponents. That's going to take us back to the Nixon days or something even worse, and that's absolutely unacceptable in the United States.
I want to play a bit of tape of an issue we looked at in Florida a couple of days ago.
It's 98.5 The Wire, Pine Hills' new radio station, your voice. Hey, don't forget Election Day. Just days away, and they say you're not coming out to vote. Well, that means you better vote. It's 98.5 The Wire.
What we're talking about here is African-American turnout, which is lower than expected and could really cost Hillary in the states which matter most.
It seems like folks aren't into it like they were with, you know, the Obama presidency, at least African-Americans locally. And that's the big problem. I don't think there's, on the Democratic side, that passion that's needed. And maybe the Trump voters have that going for them right now. I just think it's going to be a lot closer than everybody thinks.
I promise you, Anthony is coming up, but I just wanted to say this as well. The thing we got from Florida when we were in Orlando and in a predominantly African-American area was a sense of indifference, actually. That, yeah, Barack Obama, enormous enthusiasm to go out to vote. In a restaurant we went to, a lot of the people had been out to the polling stations, had voted for Hillary, but with no real sense of enthusiasm.
No, I wasn't as motivated to vote this year as I did the last two times.
So Hillary Clinton is no Barack Obama?
Nobody is no Barack Obama.
And a feeling as well that maybe after 8 years of Barack Obama, 8 years of a black president, things hadn't changed in the way that they would have hoped. There were still the cases of police brutality, there was still the inequality, there was still the day-to-day racism that affected their lives, and they felt a sense of disappointment. So as we said, a few days to go, intense activity, millions to be spent on advertising, a getting out the vote campaign across the country. It's going to be a fascinating few days. But two scenarios that I see ahead. One is, on Tuesday night, the victor will be phoned by the loser, and the loser will say, congratulations, I wish you the best. The office of the presidency is more important than any individual. I wish you Godspeed, and I will offer any support that I possibly can. Or alternatively, there'll be rancor, there'll be bad blood, there'll be cries of unfair play, there'll be suggestions that something has gone awry in the American system, and the battle will go on for days to come. I know which one I think will happen. See you next week. Bye.
John Sopel. Let's get our Business Matters headlines. Here's Jonathan.
The British government says it will appeal against a High Court ruling that it must get parliamentary approval before starting the formal process of leaving the EU. The case will be heard by 11 Supreme Court judges in December. The Bank of England has said economic growth will be better than expected next year, but it believes the impact of the EU referendum could be felt at a later date. The bank says the fall in the value of the pound could almost triple the rate of inflation by the end of next year, and growth will be lower than expected in 2018. And Egypt has taken the dramatic step of allowing its currency to float freely on the market. The Egyptian pound devalued by almost a third against the US dollar as a result.
Jonathan Izarp with their headlines through the hour. Many thanks. Professor Richard Wolff's listening to John Sopel from New York. And Richard, you know, I've got a whole list of clever questions about the economy to ask you, but I wonder whether this is the election to ask any questions about anything clever at all, because it just seems to be so brutal and nasty that is anybody talking about the big issues?
No, I think the basic problem of this election, and it was reflected in the comments a few minutes ago, is precisely that the fundamental issues that ought to be on everybody's lips, that ought to be debated, that ought to be confronted, are simply not being confronted. We are drowned in details about sexual impropriety, about emails on basically disconnected subjects that don't really pertain to what a president can or should do. We hear next to nothing about the staggering inequality that keeps getting worse in the United States, taking us back to the end of the 19th century. We don't hear a word about the instability of our capitalist economy that crashed in 2008, the second time in 75 years, the last time being the 1930s. What is to be done about it? Nothing is said. What is to be done about the suffering it costs? Nothing is said. So for me, I find the shenanigans of what's going on, the use by both parties of the FBI. If I could make a comment, everything your speaker said about the current Mr. Comey intervention is true, that it helped Trump and not Hillary. But just a few months earlier, Mr. Comey was under heavy pressure by the Hillary people to intervene in a way that helped her and hurt Mr. Trump. They're all using the FBI. They're none of them respecting these lofty principles of independence that he referred to. And I would even go so far as to say that among African Americans, something very similar has happened as it happened among white Americans, which is a disengagement from our politics, a sense of disgust. The biggest joke around the United States right now is, thank God it's over, that we don't have this continuing flailing around of ugliness. We basically have had an election campaign that is short on issues and fundamentally involves the two leading candidates, excluding the other two. We have four people running for president, by the way, mm-hmm. Four major candidates, excluding two of them for no justifiable reason.
And they never get on air.
Never get on air. I just checked the campaign numbers. Hillary Clinton, as of October 31st, raised $700 million. Jill Stein of the Green Party raised $3.5 million. Anyone who thinks that this is a democratic system must be dreaming. The two major candidates each have the same claim. Vote for me. I'm not as bad as the other one.
Mm. Rosie, listening.
This is a comment.
Yeah. Rosie, listening in China, that flailing ugliness, a very nice phrase, Professor. Is that followed by China? Are they following it for that reason, or are people willing to believe there are some real themes here?
No, I mean, earlier in the campaign, we did hear, you know, a lot of comments in China when Trump said things about China raping the US. Obviously, that was pretty provocative. But more recently, we've had pretty much entirely coverage of the scandals, the missteps, and the people are absolutely aghast at how the candidates can treat each other in public, and almost nothing about the trade or economic implications for China. So it's the same story here as well. It's all about the people. It's not to do with the policies at all.
Just say more about that, because I think probably listeners in the US might be quite surprised, because it may be a new low, this campaign, and some people have used that phrase, but there are cultures where this kind of behavior in the political arena is completely unacceptable.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Rosie, go ahead, and then I'll bring in Richard in a second.
I was just going to say, for the Chinese government, this is kind of perfect. It shows the flaws of the democratic system. It shows that, you know, give people the chance to have a say, and what will they do? They'll just slug each other's guts out in public. What's the point of that? We've got a much better system here. So, you know, it's entertainment with a very useful propaganda purpose. I'd say it's perfect.
Mm. Richard.
Well, I look upon this election as a weapon of mass distraction. It's an endless process that really runs almost 2 years in the preparation from the midterm elections last time to this point. It distracts people from the ongoing economic problems, which are very basic in the United States today, gives them something else to see on the newspaper every day and on the television every evening. And it's not just the candidates that are not dealing with the underlying issues. We're all distracted from them, and they will come crashing back on this society literally the morning after.
Rosie, just a couple of quick things, just to take it back to what we're talking about, China. You know, you say this is a perfect example of how not to do politics from a Communist Party perspective. I mean, is there any? They talked about the existential threat. We talked a bit about it earlier. There's no opposition. How can there be an existential threat if there's no opposition?
Well, it's a good question. There being no opposition doesn't mean that public opinion, that people's views don't matter. They matter hugely. And the reason the Communist Party has been so successful in China is it has adapted and it has responded to some degree to public opinion. So one of the reasons why, although on the surface the American election is great for China, it shows that democracy is terrible and a horrible example of it, there are other things that will worry the government here. And they are the fact that some, you know, even China, greatest beneficiary of globalization, has some worries that are quite similar to those in the US. There are a lot of people who are very cross at the kind of the 1% who've pulled away. Questions about inequality, how people's lives, you know, will their people's children's lives be better in the future? Will they have good jobs and things? So there is no opposition, but there's no political active opposition. There are a lot of questions about the party's future.
OK, thank you both. We're going to do one more report from France before we wind out the hour here on Business Matters, because on a visit to the Pyrenees last week, I couldn't help notice hunting season. They came out of the woods with their guns, kitted out in camouflage, not much sign of the supposedly mandatory day-glow jackets. The new season's underway across Europe. It's estimated that as many as 1 million men, yes, it is always men, blasting everything from woodcock to stags. Even in France, though, the numbers of hunters are dropping steadily, as John Lawrenson found out near the village of Anche, west of Paris.
Eight men with guns and hunting horns walk into a wood, spread out in a long line, and wait. Among them, Mathieu Andrew.
I like to look to hear all the noise in the forest. I think I am like an animal, like a prehistoric man. It's in my nature.
A deer darts out of the wood, but the angle's risky. If he'd taken a shot, he might have hit the next hunter in the line. France's deer and wild boar populations are on the rise. There are so many of the latter, rooting around in crops, ramming Renault Scenics, that hunters are allowed to shoot pretty much as many as they like. Sometimes the authorities even step in to shoot a few more. But, says the president of the Anche Hunters Association, small game, hare, quail, partridge and woodcock, is another story.
My name is Bernard Poirier. I've been hunting since I was 16. I'm 64 now. I can remember when there were 120 of us. Now we're 28. It's because of intensive farming. They've killed most of the small game.
After succeeding in shooting precisely nothing, the Anche hunt takes a break, and I hear about another reason for the decline of the French hunter, the cost. I get talking to a mechanic, a school canteen cook, a bus driver and a chip stand owner who have to pay for a gun, the bullets and the clothes that make you look like you've walked in from an East European war zone, the license and the fee for every animal you kill, up to €300 for a stag. The National Hunters Federation gives me a further reason for the disruption of hunting, people moving from the country to the towns and more generally from place to place. But whatever the cause, an old French tradition, an old French prerogative even, is under threat. Dinner table appreciation for the brace of rock partridges that were my father's glory in the film taken from the book by that name by one of France's best-loved novelists, Marcel Pagnol. Guy de Maupassant wrote enthusiastically about hunting too. So did Albert Camus. Each would have been keenly aware that the common people's right to hunt was the first won from the nobility by the French Revolution. Now, though, hunting's opponents are on the rise. No hunters, shout demonstrators in front of the Senate, the upper house of the French Parliament, where I meet François Darlot, president of France Without Hunting, a pressure group that hopes that France will follow the lead of Switzerland's Geneva Canton, which banned hunting back in 1974.
Things have changed a lot since my father's day. He was a farmer and a hunter at a time, about 50 years ago, when France had 2.5 million hunters. Now the Hunters' Federation says there are 1.2 million, but they do a bit of double counting, and it's really 960,000. The main reason for the decline is that our values have changed.
Back out with the Anche hunters. One of the hunters, Christophe Potier, his dog puts up a partridge, he aims, fires and brings it down. It struggles on the ground for a moment before his dog finishes it off and brings it to its master. One of the things Christophe's hunting friend Mathieu told me in that wood the previous day was that a generation or two ago, French country dwellers were able to kill a chicken without thinking twice about it. Not anymore. But Christophe is more old school, and he's got plans for his partridge. I'm going to pluck it and cook it, he says. Roast it probably with mushrooms.
John Lawrence reporting from Anche, just outside Paris, winding up this edition of Business Matters. Roger's here same time tomorrow. Hope you can join him. Thanks to Rosie Bloch, the economist in Beijing, Professor Richard Wolff with us from New York today. And to you for listening. Many thanks. Bye-bye.
If you've enjoyed this podcast from the BBC World Service, why not download World Business Report, a daily digest of major business, economic, environmental, and technology stories explained by BBC correspondents and expert guests. And you can listen to analysis of US economic news and market movements on our Wall Street Update.